are gardening experts with nuggets of mid-season wisdom. There's a reason so many communities hold garden tours in mid-July. It is the height of the season, with lots of flowers in bloom and vegetables to harvest. It is also the height of the pest season, with bugs such as Japanese beetles and sandflies emerging, slugs creeping out at nightfall, and voracious woodchucks taking out entire gardens in one gleeful feast. So, how's your garden this summer? Any questions? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, our experts are here to help you with all of your gardening questions. Master Gardener and Coordinator of Gardeners Growing Healthy Communities, Barbara Murphy, is here to talk vegetables. And Bill Kalina, Executive Director of the Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens, will help you with your annual, perennial shrub and tree questions. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. This is a busy time of year for gardeners, between harvesting those salad greens, to keeping the bugs off your tomatoes, to deciding what to plant next, and preparing for fall. Today, we're going to get answers to your gardening questions. With me in the studio, our favorite gardening gurus, Barbara Murphy, who is the coordinator for Gardeners Growing Healthy Communities, and Bill Kalina, the executive director of the Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens. As always, we want to hear from you. What challenges are you facing in the garden this time of year? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you both for being here on this rainy day in southern Maine. Bill Kalina, I don't want to make this the focus of the conversation, but the Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens was in the news, so I want you to talk about for DEP fines, and I want you to talk about what happened there and what you're doing now to address those.
Yeah, thanks, Jennifer. Yeah, it sounds very, serious sometimes. But basically, we're working on a expansion of our facilities right now. We're building a new visitor center and parking, that sort of thing. So we're working really closely with the DEP and the local and federal officials on the permitting stuff. And they come and make weekly inspections, much like a building inspector does. And if they find deficiencies, in this case, we had such a wet spring that we had a few small, kind of minor failures in erosion control stuff, which we're trying to avoid. I mean, we don't want any of that, so we want 100% compliance with that. But when they find deficiencies, basically, it's similar to when a building inspector says, this wiring isn't up to code and I won't give you your certificate of occupancy until you fix it. So they issue these to us, and we've corrected all the issues months ago, really. I mean, this is stuff going back from the sort of the winter and the spring when it was really wet, but it just takes a while for that system to go through. So that's basically what it is.
Okay, and where are you in the expansion?
Well, we've got the new visitor center is got the roof on. We're starting to put plants in the ground, which is the fun part for me. Seeing the trees are out there. I drove by them today, putting the first landscaping stuff in. So, I mean, our hope is to have at least the most of the facility open for the holiday light show, Gardens Aglow, in November and December. So that's what we're shooting for.
Okay, so that's the ambitious timeline.
Yes,
Good luck with that. So, and the last question before I go to Barbara Murphy, what's blooming right now at the Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens?
We're into sort of the July, so the hydrangeas, the summer flowers like coneflowers and things like that. All the summer annuals are in flower, so it's just a kaleidoscope of color there right now.
Okay. Barbara Murphy, what are you harvesting right now in the big gardens that with Gardeners Growing Healthy Communities?
Not as much as we were last year at this time, that's for certain. Mostly we're still at the greens, both wet lettuce, small herbs, beet greens, chard. Not much in the true fruiting vegetables. No green beans yet, none of those early crops. One person did hand over a few zucchini. We're still waiting.
Would you usually have green beans now?
I have had them this early, absolutely, because I keep them under cover.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
My green bean plants are just pathetic this year.
They are a heat-seeking crop, and we've had so little heat to seek.
Mm.
I got to say, not to interrupt, but I took your advice last time, and I planted my beans late, and they're doing fabulous.
Yay, one win for Barb.
So this time last year, Barb, you were telling us to go for it, to experiment, to put seeds in the ground in mid-July. We might have a long growing season. It might stretch into fall. Is that your advice again this year?
Absolutely. We're owed one. Come on, we barely had spring. We've got to have a long fall. Absolutely.
And is it still the case, Bill, that what's not so great for most vegetables has been great for other flowering plants, bushes and for perennials?
What a great gardening year. I mean, it's starting to get a little dry. I think we'd like to see, you know, this. I drove through a little rain coming down, but we need a good inch rain over a couple of days, I think, at this point. But
okay, I'm going to ask you all a question. I know you're not entomologists, but today we got a press release from the Maine Department of Health and Human Services reminding us that it is mosquito season in Maine, that there's been something called the Jamestown Canyon virus identified in the state on top of the West Nile and the Tripoli. And so, again, I'm not going to ask you about the diseases that mosquitoes carry, but because you're both outside all the time, I wanted your gardening advice for mosquitoes. Do you do anything? Do you wear DEET? Do you wear a net, Bill, or do you just sort of try to stay away from sunset in the garden?
The only thing that I do, it sounds like this would not work at all, but they have those little bracelets that are kind of a citronella bracelet, and they're kind of expandable. They're not very expensive. We sell them at our gift shop, and I think they work really well. And when you're done with it, you put it in a plastic bag, seal it up, and then it lasts for several times. So that's a pretty good, you know, if you got short sleeves on and stuff, just to keep the mosquitoes off you.
Okay. Yeah, I saw one of those a couple weeks ago and wondered about them.
Try
so
it
I'll
out,
give it a try. What about you, Barbara?
If they're really annoying, I might put some DEET or some other insecticide on. But mostly, I just swat.
I have a feeling you're one of those people. You're not like me. You don't attract them like a magnet.
Yeah. Truly, I don't. I'm one of the lucky ones.
Well, we're going to start with a question that's an email question because I think it's a great first question. This is from Marianne in Portland, and she asks, what's the single most important thing I can do to have a healthy garden?
Ready, Bill? In unison.
Soils. We practice that one.
Well, people hear that, have good soil. But what do we do? Do we put compost, a layer of compost on every spring? Do we take over? How do you have this great soil?
Well, there's two parts to soil, basically. The most basic thing is there's the stuff that comes from the rocks, the inorganic part of the soil, sand, silt, clay. And then there's organic stuff, which is anything that's sort of dead and decomposed, mostly plant matter. So you have to have some mineral soil to start with, and usually, typically in Maine, we have kind of sandy silt stuff, which isn't bad to work with. If you have clay soil, it's a little harder. But no matter what it is, as long as you got some of that, and then adding that organic material, we use compost, basically finished compost, to build the soil quality, and that makes such a huge difference. It's amazing.
When you buy a plant and it says plant in well-drained soil, is that what it means, that the sandy soil is more well-drained soil than somebody who is a clay-like soil?
Yeah, that's basically what it is, that it doesn't hold a lot. Because the problem is water in soil drives out oxygen, and roots need oxygen. So if it's got too much water in there, the roots suffocate.
Is there such a thing as soil that's too rich?
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. You can over organicize your soil, over fertilize your soil. You certainly don't want to overdo it. But I mean, typically, for my vegetable garden, and Barbara, I'm curious what you do, but I usually spread, you know, an inch or a couple inches of compost on it every spring and till it in, and mix it with a pitchfork. And that seems to do the trick for my garden at home. And that's what we do at the botanical gardens too.
Barbara, you're smiling because you're not an advocate of rototilling, are
you? No, not so much in a vegetable garden, home vegetable garden. But hey, you're okay, Bill.
And I know that you're a big advocate of the soil test.
Well, it gives you a baseline. It gives you some place to start to say if you're deficient in any of the chemical background. But now you can also have a soil test addition put on. There's the standard and the comprehensive, it's called. And it will give you some information about that organic matter component. And is it actually breaking down and delivering nutrients like you think it is? A big organic matter percentage doesn't necessarily say it's being available to your plants. And that's what that second test will give you.
And I'm going to confess that even though I have a vegetable garden, I've never done a soil test. I know, roll your eyes at me. Do I need to do one? Or if the garden's kind of big, do I do a couple in a couple different places?
It kind of depends on who, on how you manage. If your garden is relatively uniform, no big dips or wet spots, you could do one. Just make certain that you take a little bit of soil from all of the garden. If your garden has differences, and you're the type of person who, if you got two very different soil test results, you'd actually do the two versus average them, then you would take two. But most of us in our home garden things, if we could just get one done, it would be great.
Okay. And Bill, is it as advantageous for a perennial gardener as well as a as a vegetable gardener to understand your soil?
Yeah, definitely. We take soil tests regularly because the other thing that's really important is the pH of the soil. That's whether it's acidic or alkaline, because what that's doing is affecting the solubility of the nutrients and the rate of organic matter decay and everything like that. So you don't want soil that's either very, very acidic for most plants or very, very alkaline for most plants. Typically, our wild soils here are very acidic. For the wild plants that grow, that's fine, but for most cultivated plants, it's too acidic. But actually adding compost typically brings the pH up. And you can bring that pH up so it's too high, too. So the soil test is telling you how the nutrient levels of your soil, the organic matter, and also the pH, and it gives you a good sense of your soil character.
Is the reason that soil in Maine tends to be acidic because we have so many evergreen trees?
No, it actually is because most of the parent rock that the soils derive from here are acidic rocks.
Huh.
When you get up to St. John Valley, it's limestone, so they have alkaline soil, and you combine acidic rocks with high rainfall, which tends to leach out the calcium and magnesium that brings the pH up. It makes for an acidic soil.
Interesting. We'll go to Tricia, who's calling from Waldo. Hi, Tricia. Go ahead.
Hi. So I have a question about tomato hornworms, but first I'd actually like to talk about my bug protection. Years and years and years ago, I got a net. It's like a jacket. I wear a baseball cap, and I wear it all the time. This year, I just bought the net pants, and that combination, I can wear it over anything, multiple layers to keep me warm or, shorts and a tank top if it's really hot out. I also spray those with permethrin. So I'm using that protection for ticks, mosquitoes, any kind of bug. I just wear it stress-free all season. It's great.
Where'd you find those?
Oh, you can buy them on Maine used to have a creator of them. These that I found online, it was the Bug Baffler, and you get them, online. The company I chose was in New Hampshire, and they were great. And the other piece of advice is spend a little bit more money and get the kind that have a cloth cuff, kind of like on a jacket would have a cloth cuff. They're better than the scratchy ones that just have kind of like a cheap elastic binding. So you pay a little bit more, but it is so much more physically comfortable, and they keep a better seal around your wrist.
What a great tip.
Now
you get to ask your question.
Okay, great. Thank you. So I'm gardening on a new property. I've been here, this is my third summer, and the last two summers, every tomato plant I planted were devastated with tomato hornworms. And I've never seen those in 40 years of gardening anyplace else in Maine. I've never had them. So this property, they found them, or they were already here, the grubs in the soil. So, and I went out by at night, and I picked them off, and I picked them off in the daytime, and they still devastated. So I have a little kind of like a greenhouse, so I'm planting this year. I'm trying tomatoes in buckets in my greenhouse. And so I close it up at night. So my question is, do tomato hornworm moths fly at night? So if I close up everything at night, am I keeping them away? And then I open everything up during the day so that the plants will get pollinated. Is my thinking on target? And I certainly know I have new soil in the bucket, so they're not going to be grubs in the soil. Any feedback about that will be great. And I can take my question off the air if you'd like.
Barbara, go ahead.
So you're almost there. So a tomato hornworm is the larva of a night flying moth, but they don't form grubs. The moth lays usually a singular egg on the plant, and then that egg hatches and just continues to eat your tomato plant from egg size up to cigar size. So keeping your greenhouse closed at night certainly is helpful, should cut it down, but the soil relationship isn't there. So you just need to stay vigilant.
If I can jump in, what I've read about online from many multiple sources is that they do overwinter with a grub kind of creature in the soil. I've read that many, many different links. That's why I went with the buckets in the different soil. I'll research it again, but the overwintering cycle, my understanding, is through a grub. I'll call it a grub, caterpillar worm-like creature that lives in the soil, and it has like a little horned head, so you can identify.
Okay, Tricia, we're thinking that you're talking about the pupa, the baby.
So the pupa would go to an adult, and that adult would lay the egg, which gives you the hornworm. So that overwintering body isn't causing feeding damage, but is producing the adult. Is that making sense to you?
Yes, but it's perpetuating the cycle. I'm hoping to break the cycle. I'm not planting any tomatoes on my property outside of this greenhouse bucket system.
I think keeping the greenhouse closed tonight will help you. Probably won't eliminate it altogether. They have a pretty small home range, so once you get them, you tend to have them, unfortunately.
Oh. Tricia, thanks for your question. We have another pest question from Sky in Milford. Hi, Sky. Go ahead.
Hi, we have a pretty simple question, although I don't know if it has a simple answer. Is there any way to control striped cucumber beetles other than just picking them off the plant and killing them? Because that's basically what we're doing now.
And Sky, you have the same question as Kathy. And Kathy adds to her question. She's an emailer. They appeared about a week ago. I prefer organic recommendations.
Oh, striped cucumber beetles, truly the worst pest, truly, because they don't lay their eggs on the plant. So you have to eliminate that whole squishing possibility. So for early control, I leave insect netting over my crops as long as I can. So like cucumbers and squash, I have everything under netting until they get to bloom. So that's my first line of defense. And okay, here's my second one, and you can laugh, but I use a dust buster with a focus nozzle that goes down into like the funnel of the squash plants early in the morning, and I suck out the adult cucumber beetles.
I want to add too, Trista, that I years ago I worked for a researcher who grew all kinds of all kinds of plants in the potato family, and we were plagued by those. And there's a form of BT we were using for cucumber beetles. But it's been a while since I've looked to see if it's still available. But there's a place called Green Spot that sells organic stuff. So it worked great, but it worked on the larvae. So we had to wait till the grub showed up and sprayed them that way.
All right. Well, good luck to you, Sky, and good luck to you, Kathy. And we do have to take a break. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Weiler's in Brunswick, committed to offering a colorfully curated mix of local goods, clothing, and gifts on Main Street next to Local Market and Cafe. And Lighting Concept, now open in Portland and Lewiston, dedicated to lighting Maine homes with style and function. This summer, Maine Public is teaming up with Darlings and Literacy Volunteers of Bangor to share the joy of reading with children across Maine. Many children across our state have limited access to appropriate books, so Maine Public is collecting new books and pristine used books at Darlings and Maine Public locations. These books will be distributed at many of Darling's Ice Cream for a Cause stops and also at two special literacy events, one in Augusta, one in Bangor, which will include Maine Public on-air staff reading to children, photo opportunities with Clifford the Big Red Dog, and Darling's Ice Cream for a Cause truck, and other fun activities. For more information and all the details, including how to donate books, visit mainepublic.org and click on Events.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, our gardening experts are here to answer your gardening questions. With me in the studio, Barbara Murphy, a coordinator for Gardeners Growing Healthy Communities, and Bill Kalina, executive director of the Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens. We invite you to join the conversation. 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We have an email from Allison. A question for Bill. Could you please advise about when to plant perennials for a native woodland garden? What is the best time to plant our golden seal plants? Is fall planting likely to be successful? We're in the Ellsworth area.
Fall works fine because typically a lot of the woodland perennials will they'll grow obviously actively in the spring and then often go dormant or at least slow down in the summertime. But then there's a little period of root growth in the fall as there's more moisture in the soil. The key thing is just to put a good layer of leaves on top after you plant just to prevent the ice from heaving them out of the ground because they haven't fully rooted in.
Okay. We'll go to Cameron calling from Bangor. Hi, Cameron. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about how to improve my soil quality where I currently am. I have a very rocky soil. It's my first summer here, and I've planted in all containers as a result. And I don't really have a whole lot of topsoil or humus to work with. So I do have chickens, and I have chickens that produce a lot of manure in their pine shaving bedding. And I'm wondering if there's any way I can incorporate that or if that would be too acidic or too much manure. So I'm really struggling as to how to best create a well-balanced vegetable soil.
It's going to be time, Cameron. If your mineral part of your soil is really rocky and sparse in anything that you would call soil or dirt, adding manure to that is certainly giving it the nutrient boost and some biotic boost to get you going. But if you're short of – you can purchase topsoil, certainly. But if you want to just build more depth to your soil, it's going to be time.
When you say time, do you mean a couple years?
I'm talking – so give me a guess. How deep is your soil? 2 inches?
Oh, I'd have to say my average topsoil's 2 to 3 inches, and then it gets somewhat gravelly underneath that.
And by gravelly, big gravel or gravel – I mean big gravel with lots of space between them or little gravel where roots could actually still kind of grab hold and do all right?
Kind of in between there. We've got a good amount of like inch gravel rocks and then pebble size in between that. And it was recently cleared land, so it was forest, and a whole lot of the topsoil was washed away. So
you're on the building soil end of the spectrum. You know, Bill talked earlier about just an inch or so of compost. You're on the end where lots can come on now because you have basically nothing to work with. So go on ahead, but be keep your expectations relatively minimal because it's just going to take time to get the right combination of soil building and nutrient availability to happen. And that's probably a 3-year kind of time frame.
So should he shovel his wood chips with the cow manure and also some leaves and maybe also some orders of topsoil?
Absolutely, knowing that those wood shavings are going to kind of tie up those nutrients for a short while. So keep your eye on how your plants are growing and keep a liquid fertilizer on hand to kind of mask any deficiencies.
Anything to add, Bill?
I think Barbara did beautifully. I have nothing to say.
Cameron, thanks for your question. We're going to move on to Lindsay, who's calling from Gray. Hi, Lindsay. Go ahead.
Hi. I think this might be a question for Barbara. I'm wondering what is causing the yellowing in both my summer and winter squash leaves. I've combated squash borers in the past and done what I could to rotate them out and even not plant them. And I know what that looks like, but this yellowing is different. I wonder if you have any response to that.
Is it yellowing throughout the plant or just some of those early leaves?
Just some of the early leaves, but it seems to be spreading in a couple of the plants. And it's also, there's a mottling. It looks like there might be an insect on it, but it's mostly the yellowing that concerns me.
And does the yellowing have gray or black spots associated with it?
A little bit, yes.
A little bit. So I'm going to go for a couple of wild guesses. My first guess is both summer squash and winter squash are, once again, those heat-seeking crops. So I don't know when you planted them, but in general, unless you planted them late into the season, they're struggling. And then the second thing is there's a zillion fungal diseases that start off kind of yellowing the plant and with some mottling. And with our moist season, that could be it. Bill, you got some suggestions?
I mean, the only other thing would be a nitrogen, you know, deficiency or something like that, where, you would see, is the new growth looking very vigorous and healthy, and so it's growing forward very fast, just the old leaves are looking better, or is the plants overall seem kind of stunted?
Lindsay, did you hear Bill's question?
Yes, I'm sorry. It looks like the new leaves are a little bit more vigorous. And I'm wondering too if what I thought was straw that I put in as mulch, it turns out it's seeding my garden with grass everywhere. Could that actually be leaching some nutrients out of the soil?
The growing grass is taking nutrients from your soil, certainly to produce the grass. So let's try a combination of things. I would actually move the mulch away a bit in case it's holding too much moisture around your crop, and then try a little bit more fertility and see if you can just grow it out of its doldrums.
Okay.
Good luck, Lindsay. We'll go up to Nobleboro and Lisa. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm growing roses. And from year after year, I just have Japanese beetles. And nothing that I do gets rid of them. I grow organically, but I've even tried, you know, chemicals, rose dust and stuff on them. And nothing I do gets rid of the beetles.
Lindsay, you are not the only person who hates the Japanese beetles. Bill, what do you do at Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens?
Are they out now for you down here? Because we haven't seen them yet, but I'm guessing.
Well, she's in Nobleboro, so she's further east than you are. Yeah.
Any day they're coming out. And Lisa, the two things that we've done at the Botanical Gardens, and we've talked about this before because it's kind of an interesting thing. There's a parasitic fly that lays a little white, it looks like a white spot behind the head of the Japanese beetle. So if you just do a sort of a wholesale spray of the beetles, you kill the parasite too. So sometimes I'll hand pick beetles off, which some people are uncomfortable with, but not pick the ones that have the little white spot. And then there's there's something that you can put called milky spore bacteria that you can buy and spread on your lawn because, of course, the grubs are in the grass, and that kills the grubs. And it takes a few years to get going, but it is pretty effective. There's also a nematode that you can get to put on the lawn to kill the grubs. And so it's almost easier to attack the grubs in the lawn rather than to try to attack the adults, I think. But it's worked. Those two or three things together really have brought the population of beetles down at the gardens in a huge way. The roses are, you know, actually growing again.
Is there some way somebody can order those?
Not the winsome fly, but the winsome fly, we have lots of them now. They just showed up probably 5 years ago, and they're spreading. So I'm guessing in Nobleboro they have them. You can order the milky spore pretty easily. A lot of nurseries sell it. You can order it online. You just have to make sure, because it's a living thing, that it's not expired. So you need to make sure it's fresh and put it on right away. They follow the directions as far as how to apply it.
Good luck, Lisa. Let's see. We're going to go to Frederick calling from South Portland. Hi, Frederick. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Yeah. Hi, Jen. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, I have a question about composting. But I first wanted to flap my feathers, so to speak, and just give a clue about we turned over our entire front yard. It's about 50 feet long many years ago. And in response to this may be directed to Cameron's previous question about amending the soil. What we did was to treat each individual plant soil mix, you know, in a very organic manner and not really be concerned about the 50 feet of the soil, you know, as a mass of 50 feet of soil. But over the years of having then filled in the 50 feet, we've got a very rich, lush garden. You know what I mean?
I'm not sure what you mean. So you've every time you planted a plant, you built up the soil around that plant?
Exactly. Because, you know, it's recommended when you plant, and it's not vegetable, it's all perennial or ground cover, that you create a good soil condition for that individual plant. So we use peat moss and organic matter, and then soil, of course, and watered. And that's turned out to be a gorgeous garden, and the soil is fine, as we've found. So we just approached each individual plant that we put into the ground with a nice growing soil, and it seemed to have worked, judging from the beauty of our garden.
Fantastic. And thanks for the tip. And you had a question too, right?
Yeah, what we do with the compost in the back, due to various circumstances, we don't have a composter. So what we've been doing is just chopping up finely, you know, the kitchen waste, and we actually add it to the garden where we walk with grass clippings and leaf matter and other kinds of things. I think I'd much rather have a composter per se, but we don't have one. And I wonder what your guests would really recommend is the better way, the best way they've found to compost.
Frederick, I do what you do. I bury a lot of my kitchen waste and small garden scraps finely chopped up or kind of chopped up and buried. So it's kind of a rough form of sheet composting, and I do that until the ground freezes solid. So I'm right behind you. I think that's a great solution when either you don't have the physical ability or the space to have a large compost pile or heap. I don't know what Bill does.
I just put it in a pile. But I do think that the sort of the barrels and the things you can turn easily are much more effective for small, you know, doing a little bit of small composting, because to try to get a pile that you can turn to bring it up to heat so it composts is difficult.
All right. Well, good luck, Frederick, and thank you for calling. Let's see here. This is from Dawn on Facebook. I live in Scarborough. I have rhododendrons that are in various places and are 4 to 5 years old. I see rhododendrons all over Maine that are huge in sun, shade, etc. Mine seem to be very slow growing or not growing at all. They look healthy and bloom well. How do I get my rhododendrons to grow big? Is it a different variety, location, fertilizing?
There's so many different varieties of rhododendron. And in recent years, there's a species from Japan called Rhododendron yucusa mainum. And it is a more dwarf variety, and the breeders have incorporated that into a lot of the rhododendrons that are sold now just because people don't want the rhododendron that takes over your house. And so my guess is, Dawn, that you've got one of these yak hybrids, as they're called. But the ones that you see growing huge are, there's just a few. There's one called Roseum elegans, and then Nova Zembla, which are the old sort of Rhododendron cantabiense hybrid. So you have to just go and get, you want what are called the old ironclad hybrids, like, you know, Roseum elegans, if you remember that and ask for that. And they can grow, you know, 8-10 inches in a year when they're growing quick. And that's
so your guess is it that it's something she's doing, but the variety that she's planted.
That's my guess, is that you've just, the breeders are moving toward the more compact ones now just because people didn't want those, because you see the houses with the rhododendrons eating the house. You know?
Sure. We have to prune ours way back every year. Yeah.
So the breeders are responded by providing more compact rhododendrons to the market. And I'm guessing that's what she's got.
And I know that a lot of people think of rhododendron as a shade shrub, but it really isn't it really likes some sun, doesn't it?
They bloom much better in the sun. The problem that they have, like most evergreen things in the winter when the ground is frozen, that they can burn. So the ideal spot is a place that they get sun in the summertime, but when the sun is lower in the winter, they're in the shade.
All right. Well, we'll go to Richard calling from Sebago Lake. Hi, Richard. Go ahead.
Hi, guys. Hey, talking about tomato hornworms, I have a couple quick tips on those. They are so hard to spot. They're camouflaged in those same colors, the tomato greens. And so I look for their excrement. And if you see the little black dots of tomato hornworm poop, look a couple inches above, and there you'll see it.
Absolutely.
And I walk around once a day with a pair of scissors, and I just, instead of trying to pull them off the branches, I just snip them in half.
You're my kind of gardener, Richard. Absolutely.
And all the guts coming out.
Yeah. Well, when they're the size of a cigar, smushing them is tough. And for those of you who have, just one or two, if you put white underneath your tomato plant, a white sheet, paper, whatever, the excrement will drop on that. So if you aren't seeing anything, you'll at least know which tomato plant has problems. It's a good early indicator.
Okay. Right. And usually when the plants are up a few feet high, the excrement's going to be on the leaves below where they're
exactly. Feeding. And remember, they'll eat peppers too, so not just your tomatoes.
Well, thank you for your call advocating violence on Maine Calling. We do have to take another short break. When we return, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Freemasons in Maine, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine. Also, Skudik Institute, advancing ecosystem science and learning for all ages through a partnership with Acadia National Park. SkudikInstitute.org. Classical music goes well with the summer season here in Maine, and our growing Maine Public Classical Network is here to please with virtually 24/7 great classical music. Maine Public Classical is currently heard on 5 FM frequencies, Portland 104.1, Bangor 106.1, Waterville 99.7, Freiburg Bridgeton 91.5, and Millbridge MDI 93.7. If you can't hear it over the air, remember it's on the HD channel of this Maine Public Radio station you're now listening to, and also available online at mainepublic.org in a stereo stream. Maine Public Classical, how to find and listen to it. You'll find information online at mainepublic.org. And coming up in about 20 minutes in our 2 o'clock Public Affairs Hour, Climate One Radio is taking a look at how young people are taking their knowledge of climate science into the streets and into the courts, pressing for environmental change. Again, that's on our 2 o'clock Public Affairs Hour, coming up here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, how to make the most of your garden this summer. And joining me, Bill Kalina, Executive Director of the Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens, and Barbara Murphy, the Coordinator for Gardeners Growing Healthy Communities. Join our conversation. Give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. I'm going to go to a couple critter questions. Here's an email from Kirsten. Help! The neighborhood woodchuck is feasting on my garden, especially the brassicas. Every morning it seems like something new has been chomped off. I built a fence, but he seems to be able to squeeze through the holes of the green wire. I'm planning to cover that with chicken wire, but any other suggestions, including something to spray organic on my veggies?
My heart is with you. I just trapped out 4. From one of my gardens after they had decimated the melon patch and the peppers and the radishes.
I bet they were very chubby, happy
woodchucks. A nice family meal a few times. I don't know any spray that will deter a hungry woodchuck. They will go over and under fences. So it is strategic placement of traps. It truly is. Getting have a heart traps. I have good luck baiting them with cabbage leaves. And having leaves go into the trap and out of the trap. So that is the only thing other than final.
How far away do you have to take them if you're going to trap them and not shoot them?
Far. Just not by your neighbors. I have a river that has nothing around it. That has a nice sandy bank that has become the secondary woodchuck home. You know, I release them way away.
Okay, Bill. Do you have woodchucks at Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens?
Knock on wood, we don't have any woodchucks. I'm always worried that one's going to find its way in. We certainly have lots of other rodents, but luckily no woodchucks.
Okay, and this one's from Norm. I think I have moles in my lawn. All of a sudden, the grass has disappeared. There are long hills of dirt between the remaining plants. Am I correct, or is this something different? In any case, what can I do about this?
You can tell moles because they're tunneling, looking for grubs, and pushing up the lawn. The voles, which actually are eating the grass, do sort of shallow tunnels, and then they actually eat the grass. So you have to do a little. It's hard to tell from the description if it's moles or voles. the voles are things that we really, you know, trap, you know, put snap traps out and things for, because they're just, they eat the plants. The moles, we just kind of stomp down the tunnels again and let them move on.
Because moles eat the grubs that you don't want.
Yeah. So they're eating like the Japanese beetle grubs, the June bugs, all those things that are in the, and that's why people tend to put down grub killers on lawn. But of course, the grub killer is pretty toxic chemicals to use. So I would not recommend using grub killers.
So it sounds like to you that, that Norm has voles because the grass is gone.
Just from his description, yeah, voles. And they're, and they look like moles, but their eyes are bigger, and they look like a you know, big long mouse with a short stubby tail. And we put out snap traps with baited with little pieces of apple with a little molasses on there, and catch them that way.
We're going to go to Jean, who's calling from Howland. Hi, Jean. Go ahead.
Hello. I am calling to find out the easiest, quickest way to refurbish a garden that hasn't been in use for several years. I went out and worked there 6 hours Monday to get a place prepared to plant my pole beans that I started in pots, and it was a job just getting an area big enough to put my pole beans up. And what do you suggest to kill the grass and the sun, the seeds, the daisies, the weeds, and it's that will be ready for next year, I guess.
So it's an old vegetable garden plot that's turned into a weed patch.
That's correct. And first, I'd like to say something about the pole beans. I planted those a lot. What I did is I took an old child swing set and put it out there and put webbing up to the top to have the beans grow up. And I left the seed on the end so when I got tired, I could sit down.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. They're trellising for tomatoes, beans, whatever. Jean, assuming that you don't want to just physically, you know, remove the top weedy, grassy area with a shovel or something, you can till it, but tilling it is just going to give you future problems of heavier duty weeding. So those are the two manual kind of things. The problem is you're a little late to kind of deaden it with cardboard or black plastic because we don't have a whole lot of sun from now to the end of the year. But it certainly is where I would start. I would get some sort of opaque covering, whether it's cardboard, lots of it, newspaper, black plastic, and just start eliminating light from the future area of your garden. It probably won't kill everything by next year, but it'll make everything at least much more decomposed than it is now.
Good luck, Jean. We'll go to Susan, calling from Booth Bay Harbor, your neighbor, Bill. Hi, Susan. Go ahead.
Hi. My question's about lupin perennis. I planted 5 last year. These are the lupin, as I understand it, that are native to Maine, as opposed to the ones that grow all over the roads and really grow wild. But these are the native lupins, and when I planted them last year, they didn't do spectacularly, but they were all alive at the end of the year. This year, only 3 came up, and even they are really not doing well. I mean, they look like they're on the brink of just dying altogether.
Okay, Susan, good
what
question.
What do they might need that they're not getting?
And I know lupins are tough, aren't they?
Yeah, and Susan brings up a good point that the wild lupins you see growing on the roadsides are the garden escapes. And then there is a native northeastern lupin that grows typically in very sandy, exposed situations. And it's not an easy plant to grow unless you have a very, you know, that kind of soil. Sandy, not a lot of competition. And I'm not sure, Susan, where you have it, whether it's if that's the sort of conditions that you have. But if you do have a very gravelly, sandy soil in full sun, it will grow reasonably well. But that's about it.
Is it one of the plants like Rugosa rose that doesn't really like rich soil very
much?
That's
right. Yeah, definitely.
Susan, thank you for your call. We're going to go to Thelma in Sorrento. Hi, Thelma. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes, I have a very nice patch of daylilies, but right beside it, some wild raspberries have planted themselves. And for the last 2 years, they're really encroaching, and I need to get rid of them before they take over my daylilies. How do I do that? They're not in the daylilies yet, but they're right next door, and they're coming.
They're coming all right. I mean, really, the only way to get rid of them without using chemicals is to get the roots and the rhizomes out. And that's just because if you just keep cutting them, they'll just keep sprouting up. In fact, I think they like to be cut. You know, it makes
Barbara's
them mad.
Nodding. And,
but that's really the only way to do it. But you can just if you have a pitchfork or something like that that you can kind of stick in the ground and loosen the soil up, as you have a gloved hand and pull up the canes, you can usually get them out reasonably easily. I think, but that's really the only way to do it without using the chemicals on them.
Oh, good luck, Thelma. We have an email from Bjorn. I have a green and yellow zucchini plant. The yellow one is a little further along and it has two little zucchini, which both turned soft and fell off when they were about an inch long. Why? And what do I do?
Early season pollination and calcium issues. Just wait. We just need some even heat and that won't happen anymore. So quite common. It's blossom end rot probably just in the zucchini.
So leave your plant and hope for sun and warmth?
Yeah.
Consistent sun and warmth?
Usually early fruits on tomatoes and zucchini and cucumbers have this issue. So it's just early season problems.
Okay. An email from Rebecca. I have 3 acres or so of wild blueberries that are being overrun by basically weeds, and it's not possible for me to burn the field. So I'm wondering what the best way to handle them without resorting to herbicides. Encourage the berries, but discourage the weeds. We do mow right down to the dirt in the fall, but the weeds are pretty hardy. I'm in Lovell.
I'm going to throw this to the professionals at Cooperative Extension. I would call Dave Yarber or Charlie Armstrong. They are the two wild blueberry specialists.
Okay. Going to go to Dan in Cumberland Forsyth. Hi, Dan. Go ahead.
Yes, just a quick comment. My wife is an avid gardener. She was picking Japanese beetles off of her plants in her garden a number of years ago. And then she was crushing them to kill them. And then she happened to put her finger in her eye, and her eye immediately became inflamed. It's not very attractive, but the eye almost looked like it was turning into a gel. We rushed her to the ER in Maine Med, where they rinsed it, and I believe they gave her an ointment to counteract it. But they did mention to us that there is some kind of toxin that can be that people can be very allergic to. We were terrified she would lose the eye. Fortunately, everything was okay. But just a word of caution.
Yeah,
that's
really good to know.
What the toxin is? I don't know what the toxin is. I don't remember.
Wow.
Maybe one of your guests can answer that question, but just a word of caution.
Thanks, Dan. So if you're picking the Japanese beetles off, especially if you're doing it with bare hands, don't wash your hands afterwards. Don't touch your eyes.
Yeah, and what she was crushing them too, so she's getting the, you know, that we typically when we pick them, we just put them in a thing of soapy water and they drown in there rather than crushing them.
I had an email I wanted to go to, and now I've lost it. Hold on just a second, guys. I can't find it, but what it was, Barbara, somebody was asking if in raised beds the soil needed extra fertilizer.
Not necessarily. Raised beds drain more rapidly, so if your soil is sandy and you have soluble nutrients, then yes, that's possibly true. But good organic matter or more silt-based soils wouldn't necessarily have to have more nutrients.
Okay, and I did find the email. She was asking, what about the raised beds, especially with all this rain? Is that?
That's true in all of our gardens, raised or not, especially if you use a synthetic 10-10-10 or a Miracle-Gro type fertilizer. Those are being probably washed through pretty rapidly.
Wondering if your guests, this is from Jeff, have any wisdom on getting rid of invasive violets in garden and lawn?
Violets are not technically invasive, so that's one of those terms that people use for, you know, the technical term is if it's introduced, it can be invasive, but violets are a native plant. The thing about violets, which is they have a great strategy of they flower, but then they also produce seeds underground in the summertime. And there really isn't a great way to get rid of them in lawns, again, without using chemicals, other than just having the grass growing really healthy. I think one of the things that helps grass compete is the pH. So if you bring the pH up, get it a little bit higher, The violets will grow, but the grass will grow better, and that's just putting down limestone. In the garden, it's just staying on top of them and pulling them out because they produce all those seeds, and there'll be a thousand where there was one the year before.
I kind of like them.
I like them too. I mean, and they're one of the things that you can think they're the food source for the great fritillary butterflies, which are the big, colorful, spotted butterflies that you see around in the summertime. So you have some violets in your yard. You're providing the food for the caterpillars there. So I kind of like them in my lawn, leave them there.
Email from Mimi. I grow lamb's quarters for consumption. I can recognize leaf minor damage, but I also get a freckling of yellow or green on the leaves. The freckles enlarge and merge into blotches. I've been in touch with the insect expert at University of Maine Cooperative Extension who ruled out insect damage from a sample. Doesn't seem to be soil, light, or location related. Haven't had the nerve to eat these leaves.
Bill?
That's I love people that are growing weeds for food. I mean, that's great.
Absolutely.
There's a fungus that causes sort of a spotting that you get some red pigmentation around it. That's the one that I'm familiar with. I really have no idea if that's something that would be unsafe to eat. So.
Okay, I think we have time for one more. Solange on Facebook. Can you discuss black swallowwort? I see it everywhere in Portland's East End. I've got mine under control after years of concerted effort. What is black swallowwort?
Black swallowwort is an invasive species, so it's an introduced plant in the milkweed family, and it's a perennial, spreads underground. It's sort of a scandent plant or a vine, and it has seed pods that look like milkweed pods, and the seeds open up. And I've seen reports that sometimes it fools the monarch butterflies and they lay their eggs on it, and then the caterpillars can't develop. I'm not positive that's true, but it's just a kind of a nasty new invasive plant, and because it spreads underground the way that the bamboo does, it's difficult to eradicate other than just constant pulling it out.
Which, and I'm surprised in this hour we didn't get any questions about Japanese knotweed, but your answer is to, as my husband's grandfather would say, just worry it to death. Just don't give up, right?
That's right.
Well, thank you both for being here. As always, Barbara Murphy, coordinator for Gardeners Growing Healthy Communities. That's out in Western Maine. Beautiful vegetable gardens that provide vegetables for all kinds of people. William Kalina, executive director of the Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens. Jonathan Woodward ran the board today. Dan Plummer answered your calls. You can find past editions of Maine Calling and a link to our archives at mainecalling.net. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, the latest news from the world of pet care. Two veterinarians in the studio to answer your questions about animal health and welfare. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.